It's Dr. Drew. Midday Live with Mike Catherwood.
That is us, and our phone number is 800-222-5222, Midday Live. We are going to have the privilege to speak to Yale psychiatrist and professor of psychiatry, Dr. Bandy Lee, in just a moment. I've got her webpage up in front of me. She has extensive training. She is a specialist in criminal psychology. She does public health, social justice. Violence is one of her very significant areas of training. In addition, she has psychology, phenomena, and process, anthropology, education. She has a broad range of training. And when I first heard about the ruckus about Mr. Trump's psychiatric or mental health, I thought, oh, here we go again. Who's making these claims? And then I looked up Dr. Lee and I thought, well, if somebody's making these claims,
she's the real deal.
She is the one that's making these claims. And she very kindly agreed to come on the program today. So, Dr. Lee, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So my question is, what criteria were you using? What data points did you have? And then what did you conclude?
Well, first of all, let me say I'm speaking on my own behalf and not representing the views of my institutions, Yale University, Yale School of Medicine, or Yale Department of Psychiatry. Mm-hmm. First of all, I'm not interested in Mr. Trump's personal health. It's really a private affair. But when they come to have effects on public health by virtue of the office that he holds, then it becomes a matter of public health. And actually, it has gotten to the point where it's become a danger to national and international security.
I'm going to try to put a fine point on what you say, and you tell me if I'm getting this correctly. So it's not so mm-hmm. much that you, if you were evaluating him as an individual, you would put him on a 72-hour hold or 5150, or you would mandate medication or care with the co-signature of two other physicians. It's more that you're looking at through the perspective of public health. Is that accurate?
That's right. Only his effects on the public by virtue of Mr. Trump being in the office of the presidency, is this any of my concern. And actually, I'm not the only one. As you know, there is a book that has 27 of us, but we actually represent a national coalition now that is thousands with the same medical consensus that this situation poses a risk.
Okay, and of course the press doesn't do a very good job of really articulating your position. So let me ask this. Here's what concerns me about taking a position like this. I know you've been accused of essentially insurrection by suggesting something like this. My fear is that if you set up a set of criteria, and again, you haven't really told me what the criteria are yet, and we understand sort of in broad strokes what you're talking about, but I would think if we were really going to do such a thing, you'd have to have a set of criteria that were agreed upon by a panel of physicians. How would anybody get through 2 years in the presidency without somebody attacking them or coming after them? Because the kinds of people that enter this office have certain liabilities that if you set up criteria, many of them might meet that criteria.
It's really actually a clear distinction. It's not something that is ambiguous. That's where mental health professionals, experts.
Let me describe. Let's play a little game, real quick. Let me describe a person in a public office. This man is middle-aged. He comes from wealth. He has done very erratic business ventures. He speaks tangentially. He roams the streets at night and beats people up in the office. He had an office in law enforcement at one point. Then he had a position where he was buying battleships. And in a higher office, he could not sit down, was walking constantly, was very irritable and irascible, and extremely impulsive. Should that guy be in office?
Well, I mean, that would be a very, very concerning person.
Yeah. How about this one? Let me give another one.
Yes.
This guy had a long history of depression, and there's a story of him being so profoundly depressed that one day he was walking down the street and his son, he was pulling a red wagon. And by the way, his doctor had him on mercury, and who knows what that might have done to his mental status. And the wagon flipped over, and the child dropped out of the wagon. And this, in his fugue depression, continued to walk for another half mile down the street. Is that somebody that should be in office?
I wouldn't speak to whether or not the person should be in office. It does look like the person would need an evaluation.
Yeah, and so the first one was Theodore Roosevelt. The second
one was Lincoln?
Abraham Lincoln. Yeah. And so that's my fear, that if we start creating these things, we're going to they're going to be applied in ways they're going to be have unintended effect. That's my fear.
Exactly. So we're really not talking about mental illness here or what the person has. I mean, that is really a private affair. What is of a concern is whether or not the person has the capacity to serve. And his function, his or her function, is what of public concern. And one does not have to have a mental illness to be unfit to serve. Also, having a mental illness does not make one not have the capacity to serve. In fact, it's even said that Abraham Lincoln's depression may have increased his ability to have compassion.
Yes.
So, it really does not depend on the labeling, the diagnosis. And I'm not purporting that anyone can make a diagnosis from afar. I actually am of the camp that believes you cannot diagnose someone from afar.
Well, I mean, if somebody, to be fair, if somebody, I mean, much like if you look at a picture of a rash, I mean, when we teach medical students about mania, we show them a video. I mean, you can see mania at a distance. You just don't know the details. That's all. Right?
You can see mania, but not make the diagnosis.
Okay.
Because it could come from a medical condition. It could come from a psychiatric or neurological condition.
You really have to have
all the information to be able to make a diagnosis. But to be concerned about danger, to assess dangerous risk, you do not need to have all information. In fact, you just need enough information to cause you concern. And that's actually what I and this group, this growing group of a national coalition of thousands of mental health professionals that is really unprecedented in the history of the United States.
You're right. And I want to put a really fine point on it because the way the press is reporting your story is not being properly articulated. Am I correct about that? The headlines are stuck.
I mean, it's bound to be sensationalized. There are many misconceptions about psychiatry. And that is why I am out there, in fact. I am doing this solely for public education because I certainly have not been inclined to do this without in another situation.
Were you at all reticent to even speak up?
Oh, of course.
Even though I know you have certain obligations as an MD, were you reticent to speak up considering the political climate today, the partisan zeal?
Sure, she was.
I knew it probably.
Well, I knew of that it would be inevitably politicized, and I don't know if there will be ever an end to assigning partisan motivations.
Right.
But as a medical professional, it's paramount that I keep with my professional boundaries and maintain integrity, and that's exactly why I started with an ethics discussion, a conference that I held at Yale, and that's the conference that it happened in April of last year that got a lot of press. You know, it was, of course, totally misrepresented. It said
I want to
the Goldwater Rule.
We're skirting the Goldwater Rule. We're skirting the edges of the Goldwater Rule. But let's dig into a little bit. So two things you said that are really fascinating to me. One is you said that having a mental health issue, a major mental health diagnosis, does not preclude office. And that's a really important position to take because anything else is really adding to stigma, right? And so if you don't want to reduce stigma, we got to articulate that one. So that I agree with that wholeheartedly.
Right.
And because our political system is so complex, who knows what assets somebody needs in a particular historical context that makes a good leader? I mean, most of them have, you know, narcissism and bipolar. That's historically, that's just the way it is. But your point is, again, that it's the effect on the public health. And so in a way, you're talking about a revolution of the relationship between mental health, medicine, and our political system, right? Isn't that what you're really asking for?
Yes. I mean, I should emphasize that I myself am not really that political. I'm apartisan, yeah. Believe it or not. I've never registered for any party, never really strongly attached myself. But I have done a great deal of policy work. And the policy work that I've to do is prevention of violence, because violence is something that by the time you get to the individual, it's usually quite difficult to treat, but it's very easy to prevent, and we know it's preventable because now we have incredible amount of research showing what we need to do to prevent violence.
But prevent violence. So, hang on a second. But prevent violence in a social context, not in a geopolitical context, right?
Oh, absolutely. No.
Right. Because geopolitically, all the literature is on game theory, which is totally separate from you and I helping people reduce their risk of aggression.
I come from a public health background. I don't deal with theories like game theory. I deal with concrete evidence. So this is public health results, which deal with epidemiology, statistics. So it's really concrete numbers of violent deaths.
I'm gonna just again, if you don't mind, refine it, because I don't think you meant exactly what you said. I mean, game theory is a mathematical model. It's strictly speaking math. You're talking about clinical data. You come from a clinical perspective, which is a slight,
exactly.
Which is not an abstract mathematical.
A health perspective.
Yeah, a health perspective.
Health perspective of what treatments work for which conditions. And we now know societally what things matter, which conditions promote health and which conditions increase death.
So,
and
give us a brief primer on that? Give us like a minute on what that is.
I'm sorry.
Give us a brief primer. I'm imagining it's childhood without trauma. I'm imagining it's stable environment. I'm imagining it's certain educational instruments.
Yes. I mean, so in violence prevention, we go by an ecological model, where even individual violence is actually not just the individual. It's also kind of like the biopsychosocial model in medicine. So in other words, in every illness in medicine, there are biological, psychological, and social factors. In terms of violence, there are individual factors, relationship factors, family, community, and societal factors. And we know that preventing violence in the individual.
And we think that translates to a geopolitical level? Do other countries agree with that?
Yes.
Let me.
Actually, the World Health Organization did a study of 133 countries. Received reports from 133 countries. Something like that had never been done before. That was in 2014. They had deliberately changed their laws, law enforcement methods, instituted programs nationwide, oftentimes, but very large scale.
Yeah, but,
and
but those
were
aren't,
able
those
to
aren't,
come back
those
and
are...
report back.
Those are intra, not inter-country violence, right? Intra-societal.
So let me just explain.
Yeah.
So globally, there was a decrease by 16% of interpersonal violence, and
sure.
that was while it was actually a shift in trends. It went from accelerating violence over time to suddenly shifting. And showing a decline worldwide because of deliberate, planned implementation of the World Health Organization's recommendations. In violence studies, we actually don't distinguish that much between individual violence, collective violence, and, in fact, even structural violence.
Military violence, though, is what we've been talking about, right? Do you differentiate? Let me remind everybody, because people tune in out, this is Dr. Bandy Lee. She's a Yale psychiatrist. She got on the crosshairs of the press because of a conference she held and also some briefing she did of some certain congress members regarding the Now, as we're hearing it from her, the impact Mr. Trump's behavior is having on public health. And I think that we've only have just brief time with you, Dr. Lee, and I do appreciate it.
Sure.
Let's sort of distill it down to the way people think about these things, if you don't mind. And so I hear you saying, quote, Mr. Trump is not crazy or having a major mental health issue.
He could be. He's showing signs of it, but we don't know. And actually, it's really none of our business. Our business is whether he can carry out the function of his office. The inability to, or one might even call it unfitness for duty, can come from many different sources. It could be mental illness. It could be a medical condition making one unconscious, for example. It could be medical. It could be psychiatric, or it could be we normally don't call it individual pathology, but it is kind of a social pathology that is proneness to violence, and that is what I have been speaking to the most, because he has shown a lot of violent tendencies. And he's directly violent, dangerous as well as indirect.
So would it be accurate to say anyone prone to aggression or violence should not be in office, regardless of the will of the people?
Usually that is a criterion for most jobs. In international affairs, as you know, a lot of violence does occur, and it is a bit of a culture of violence. It has to be well reasoned. It has the decision making has to be rational, based on reality, following a logical process.
So the will of the people, the Constitution, should take second priority to these established criteria that you're trying to make.
No. It's so that the will of the people could be carried out. So we're talking about just minimal capacity here. We're not saying we would, mental health professionals, would determine who can be president or not, or select select out someone who's already there. What we do is simply to test the minimal capacity that is required to carry out whatever they have told the public they would carry out, whatever they are themselves intending to do. It's that ability to carry out one's intentions, the ability to even access one's intentions. All those things could be impaired. And so competency, capacity evaluations are actually quite routine. It can be done for anything from the capacity to stand trial.
Is there an instrument out there that you think cuts close to what you'd like to see?
Instrument? Yes. I mean, it goes through a standard procedure. There are fitness for duty exams. I mean, military officers go through them.
Is there a sort of a form they have to fill out, sort of a general sort of?
It is a standardized exam.
Right.
It's a clinical protocol that you can simply apply to whatever position.
Yep.
There's no reason you can't do the presidency.
Okay, my friend. Thank you so much for spending time with us. I really appreciate it. And, I know this comes from a sincere place, and I know you're properly trained to be able to make these assessments, so I certainly would not. That is not. No one should be attacking you on that.
Yes, it's a very concerning condition, and it has to be stated as such.
All right, thank you.
You shouldn't skirt around it.
More than anything, I was so worried this was going to add to stigma because this was, somebody's crazy. Mm-hmm. Therefore, they shouldn't be functioning. It's like that doesn't help us.
There's a lot of secrecy and stigma out there. I'm trying to break those by informing the public, but at the same time, there is this critical emergency that I have to address.
Okay,
and so that actually comes first, unfortunately. But I try my best.
Appreciate your opinion, Dr. Bandy Lee. Thank you so much. Talk Radio 790 KBC.